All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 640 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, I'm going to be continuing the USMLE 386. Again, like I said, these are specs questions, but they're very good for people prepping for step two or step three. We did series one last time, questions 1 to 10. So I'm going to do questions 11. I'm going to try to shoot for 11 to 20, but 11 to 20 have a ton of concepts I want to address, so I don't know if I'll get to 20, so we'll see. All right, so question 11. A 13-month-old child is brought to the emergency department because of urticaria, swelling of the lips, and difficulty breathing immediately after eating an egg. A potential risk for hypersensitivity reaction is posed by vaccination against which of the following illnesses, right? Option A is hepatitis, option B is influenza, option C is pertussis, option D is poliomyelitis, option E is typhoid fever. For this one, I think I'd go with influenza, right? So this person basically has anaphylaxis, probably from an egg allergy, right? So remember the influenza vaccine, these are high yield to know for your exams, right? The influenza vaccine and the yellow fever vaccine, those are grown in like eggs. So the vaccines may contain ovalbumin, right? So if people have history of egg allergies, they may have some problems with these vaccines, influenza and yellow fever. But the thing is, having an egg allergy is not a contraindication to the influenza vaccine. You know, what may just need to happen is that you give them the vaccine and you probably just monitor them for like a half hour or something to make sure that they don't develop anaphylaxis symptoms. But actually, it's very high yield to know this. An egg allergy is not a contraindication to the yellow fever, to the influenza vaccine. And again, remember, the agent that really triggers the hypersensitivity is ovalbumin. O-V-A-L-B-U-M-I-N. Ovalbumin. 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 This is one of those things where you either know it or you don't, right? So there's like the other answers are not growing in eggs, right? But the key egg wants to know, influenza and yellow fever. All right, question 12. A 42-year-old white man is brought to the ED by his same-sex partner because of confusion, diplopia, and mild weakness of his right arm. The patient is somewhat agitated and shows confusion for recent events. Temperature is 100.1 degrees Fahrenheit. There is decreased pupillary response on the left with paresis of lateral gaze on the right. Peripheral leukocyte count is increased. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in evaluation of this patient's neurologic signs and symptoms? Right? So if you notice, this person seems to have, you know, the person has fever, the person has altered mental status, right? Is agitated, right? And this person seems to have like these neurodeficits, right? So again, it's maybe hard to say exactly what's going on here, but let's look at the answers and then we'll kind of talk through this, right? I think this is a good question. So option A says bilateral carotid arteriography. Option B says CT scan of the head. Option C says EEG. Option D says LP for examination of CSF. Option E says serum HIV antibody test, right? So the thing is, this guy, you know, same sex, so maybe he has HIV, right? But the thing is, he has very acute complaints that we need to address, right? HIV, you're not going to die from HIV right now, right? But he has acute complaints we kind of need to address, right? And this acute complaint involves neurologic dysfunction. You know, he probably has meningitis or something like that. Who knows, right? But the thing is, whenever a person, you suspect the person has meningitis or encephalitis, right? And you're seeing all these neurodeficits, a lumbar puncture initially is contraindicated. You want to go ahead and do a CT of the head first. And then if that CT is negative, doesn't show like signs of increased ICP, then you can do a lumbar puncture. So I will say option B, right? A CT of the head makes sense here. I will certainly do that before considering option D, which is the lumbar puncture, right? And then after I fix his acute complaints, then I could consider option E, which is the serum HIV antibody test. I would not pick option C, EEG, because this person doesn't appear to have seizures. And I will not pick option A, bilateral carotid arteriography, because we're not worried about this person having like carotid stenosis or whatever. Like, that's not really what we're concerned about here. All right. So question number 13. A 35-year-old man is brought to the ED because of altered mental status. He is disoriented and complains about his vision. You have been his physician for the past 3 years. He has type 1 diabetes mellitus and a known history of intravenous drug use. You last saw him two weeks ago. At that visit, his serum glucose concentration was 150 milligrams per deciliter. Today, vital signs are a temperature of 38.1, that's 100.5 degrees Fahrenheit. His pulse is 110 and his blood pressure is 190 over 70. On physical examination, pupils are constricted. Fundoscopic examination of the left eye following dilation is shown. Which of the following is the most appropriate test at this time? Option A says blood cultures. Option B says chest x-ray. Option C says hemoglobin A1C. Option D says HIV antibody titer. Option E says plasma reading activity. So again, let's be careful here, right? So what do we think this guy has, right? So this guy's altered, right? We see this weird fundoscopic exam image, right? We see that he has a history of IV drug use. He has a fever. He's tachycardic. He has a white pulse pressure. Man. Just so many things here are pointing to endocarditis, right? If we even look at this fundoscopic exam image, it's kind of worrisome. You'd be like, Divine, what do you mean by it's kind of worrisome? Well, look at this hemorrhage in his eye, right? And he has all these punctate, you know, like whitish. So we have like this red above the macula. And then we have all these punctate things, right? Those are rough spots. This guy has endocarditis, right? And whenever a person has endocarditis, you always want to get a blood culture first. You typically want to get about two blood cultures or thereabouts first before you start any treatment, right? So please, I'll say for purposes of the USMLE exams, do not begin endocarditis management if you have not gotten blood cultures, right? That'd be a terrible idea, right? Get blood cultures because, again, the person is likely going to have to be on long-term antibiotic therapy, right? So knowing exactly what bug is causing the problem is helpful. So I'd go with option A here. Chest x-ray, no, you know, blood cultures are the right first thing to do. Hemoglobin A1C, again, this guy has more pressing issues. Deal with the more pressing problems first before you start worrying about, like, you know, and this guy has type 1 diabetes. We know that already, but whatever, right? So option D, HIV antibody titer, no, maybe we should check that at some point. But again, plasma reading activity, oh, you know, his blood pressure is 190 over 70. I don't think he has the high blood pressure because he has a, like some, you know, renal artery stenosis or whatever, right? And renal artery stenosis would be quite unusual in a 35-year-old. I think for this guy, I'm going to go blood cultures, right? So the white pulse pressure may actually indicate that he has like aortic regurge. Remember, aortic regurge has a very strong association with white pulse pressure, right? So that may even tell us that, hey, this guy's got valvular disease, right? So, but yes, I agree that this guy likely has infectious endocarditis. So I'm going to go with option A for this one. All right. Now, question 14 says, a 38-year-old white man, white letter carrier, returns to the office for follow-up of abnormal results of a liver chemistry profile ordered 3 weeks ago during a routine exam. At that time, physical examination disclosed no abnormalities, but serum AST concentration was 72. Serum bilirubin and ALK force concentrations were within the reference ranges. Medical history is significant for an episode of hepatitis A at age 22. He has no history of transfusions or intravenous drug use. He drinks 2 to 3 beers daily. That's a lot of beer. Today's follow-up lab study results are shown. So his anti-HAV is positive. Anti-HBS, anti-HB surface is negative. HB surface antigen is positive. HB E antigen is positive. And then he says, which of the following is the most appropriate next step? Option A says, begin interferon alpha therapy. Option B says, begin corticosteroid therapy. Option C says, instruct him to cease alcohol consumption and retest him in 2 months. Option D says, order HEP B virus PCR tests. Option E says, schedule a liver biopsy, right? So what's going on here, right? So this guy definitely has active HEP B, right? He has active HEP B. The HEP B surface antigen is positive. The HEP B E antigen is positive, right? So, you know, pretty high infectivity. That's kind of concerning here. And the anti-HAV being positive, you know, means, you know, which makes sense, or at least with the history, right? He's had Hep A before, you know, so he's generated immunity to it. And then anti-HBS is negative, right? So it means that, again, this guy does have Hep B, right? He does have Hep B. So the thing is, You know, so he seems like he probably has acute hep B, you know, but doesn't seem to have any symptoms, you know, he's pretty okay, right? So what answer should we pick here? Well, let's look at this, right? So option A says begin interferon alpha therapy. I would not do that. I mean, like, even think about it. How do we manage hep B? What's the first line treatment for hep B? Chronic hep B, if you want to manage it. You should do like entecavir or tenofovir, right? Those are going to suppress the infection, right? We shouldn't do interferon alpha. Interferon alpha has a lot of contraindications, right? And again, we use it for managing chronic hep B. Because remember, chronic hep B is when you've had hep B, you know, you've had acute hep B and your immune system doesn't clear it. You know, it's like you've had this problem now for 6 months or more, right? It doesn't look like this guy in this question has chronic hep B, right? So it's like, why do you want to start giving antiviral therapy when we don't know if he has chronic hep B or not, right? Because the thing is, more than 90% of adults that have hep B, they do clear the infection and it doesn't become a chronic infection. So I would not pick option A. I certainly would not pick option B. I mean, that seems like a very good way to increase our viral replication. Option C looks like a pretty good one, right? Stop drinking because, again, like, you already have liver injury from hep B. Why do you want to keep crushing your liver by drinking alcohol, right? Just retest him in 2 months. He may have cleared the infection by then. Again, like I said, more than 90% of adults, they spontaneously clear hep B. Option D says, order hep B viral PCR. No, we know he has hep B, right? We will do the hep B viral PCR if we know that, okay, we'll probably want to start treatment. But again, let's wait to see if he clears the infection or becomes a chronic hep B carrier. And then option E, liver biopsy. That's way too invasive. Like, come on, there's so much workup that has not been done here. All right. So I'm going to go with option C for that one. All right, let's go to question number 15. A 75-year-old white woman returns to the office. After 6 months of missed appointments, she says she's feeling depressed. You have been treating her for years for a variety of disorders, including bipolar disorder, hypothyroidism, AFib, peptic ulcer disease, and hypertension. She takes daily lithium carbonate, levothyroxine, haloperidol, sertraline, benztropine, digoxin, propranolol, ranitidine, and warfarin. Man, that's a long list of drugs. That is a long list of drugs, right? She says, I'm doing fine except for shakiness in my hands. She also says her mood is a little depressed. She has no hallucinations or delusions. Vital signs are a pulse of 78 per minute with an irregular rhythm. Blood pressure of 160 over 95 millimeters of mercury. Physical examination shows a fine tremor of the hands when they're extended. On memory testing, she recalls one of three objects after 2 minutes. Which of the following is the most likely cause of this patient's depression, right? So this person is depressed. She's taking a lot of meds. So this is a question about drug side effects, right? Option A says benztropine. Option B says digoxin. Option C says haloperidol. Option D says propranolol. Option E says ranitidine, right? I'm going to go with option D here, right? Beta blockers, right? They have a very strong association with causing depression and they can also cause erectile dysfunction, right? Remember, your beta blockers, you know, like propranolol, they are lipophilic. They can cross the blood-brain barrier. They can go into the brain, block beta receptors in the brain. Believe it or not, there are beta receptors in your brain, right? And that can decrease norepinephrine production. That can cause problems like depression, right? Let me not say decrease norepinephrine production, but you can dumb down norepinephrine effects. And that can cause you to be depressed. Because remember the monoamine hypothesis of depression, right? That people that have reductions in serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine will have depression symptoms, right? So if you're dumbing down the effects of norepinephrine because it cannot act on its receptors, that can cause you to have problems, right? So I'm going to go with option D here. Remember, benztropine, we use it to treat Parkinsonism, which is a side effect of antipsychotics, so that's wrong. Option B, digoxin. Digoxin causes atrial tachycardia, causes AV block, causes yellow vision. We don't see any of those here, so that's wrong. Option C is haloperidol, right? It causes extrapyramidal side effects. But they're not asking about extrapyramidal side effects. They're asking about depression, right? And then option E, ranitidine, not a big deal. So I'm going to move on from that. All right. Question number 16. A 68-year-old man is in the hospital because he requires mechanical ventilation for an exacerbation of COPD. On the second day after admission, he developed a pneumothorax on the right side that required tube thoracostomy. An air leak is noted for the next 24 hours, which now has stopped. However, the patient has become restless and combative. Breath sounds are diminished in the right side of the chest, and the patient now has tachycardia. Blood pressure is 130 over 80 millimeters of mercury. After ordering a stat possible x-ray of the portable x-ray of the chest, which of the following is the most appropriate next step? Option A, add 4 centimeters of PEEP, positive end expiratory pressure. Option B, administer beta-blocking medications. Option C, administer alprazolam. Option D, remove the patient from the ventilator and ventilate him with a bagged valve mask. Option E, reposition the chest tube. All right, so what's going on here? What's the pressing issue here? Well, seems like this guy has, he had COPD exacerbation. We did mechanical ventilation, developed a pneumothorax. You placed a chest tube. That's what tube thoracostomy stands for. And then we had this air leak, but it's resolved. But now, right, focus on the now. Breath sounds are diminished, right? He's tachycardic, right? You see a person that develops sudden tachycardia, diminished breath sounds. That's probably a pneumothorax. This guy's probably developed a new, spanking new pneumothorax. Well, remember, the way we treat a pneumothorax is with chest tubes. So the answer that makes sense here as a chest tube answer is option E. So I'm going to pick option E for this, right? I'm going to pick option E for this because this guy, when a patient is on a ventilator, they can be thrashing about, right? So they can dislodge things. Because remember, a chest tube is supposed to be within the pleura. It's supposed to be intrapleural, right? Because when you have a pneumothorax, you have buildup of intrapleural air. So you put the chest tube in the pleura, right? So maybe it's not in the pleura. So maybe repositioning it will help with this recurrent pneumothorax, right? And also we're getting the chest radiograph we're getting, number one, will help us confirm that the chest tube is in the right place. And number two will also help us confirm, like, is this a new pneumothorax or not, right? So I'm going to go with option E for this one. Reposition the chest tube. That's like helping the pneumothorax he has now, right? Remove the patient from the vent and ventilate him with a bag valve mask. When a person may have acute respiratory complaints, why would you want to use a less good form of ventilation than the intubation he has? Alprazolam, I would not do that. That's a benzo, right? Administer beta blockers. Why are we doing that? 4 centimeters of PEEP. Are we trying to treat ARDS here? No, right? So I'm going to go with option E for this one. All right, question 17. A 36-year-old man comes to the office because of headaches that began 2 weeks ago. The headaches are moderately severe, are present when he awakens in the morning, and are relieved with over-the-counter analgesics. He has no prior history of headaches. He tells you he was promoted to an upper-level managerial position in his accounting firm about 8 months ago, which necessitated relocating. Physical examination now discloses no abnormalities except for blurring of the optic disc margins bilaterally. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step? Option A says, begin a trial of beta blockers. Option B, order CT of the head. Option C, order EEG. Option D, refer him for consultation with a neurologist. Option E, refer him for consultation with a neurosurgeon, right? So what does this guy have, right? So we see like chronic headaches, right? Present when he awakens in the morning. And then we see blurry vision. What does this sound like? Well, this sounds a lot like pseudotumor cerebri. Remember, the older term for this is the newer term for this is idiopathic intracranial hypertension. Idiopathic intracranial hypertension, right? So how do we manage pseudotumor cerebri? Well, the first thing we do is a lumbar puncture, right? We're going to notice increased CSF opening pressures. Typically, it's going to be more than 200, right? And then you're going to start treating them with acetazolamide. But the thing is, if they have signs of increased ICP, right? Like, for example, this person certainly has signs here. He says physical examination now discloses no abnormalities except for blurring of the optic disc margins bilaterally. That's kind of worrisome, right? So in that case, if you suspect, kind of like the meningitis question we did a few moments ago, you want to probably go ahead and do a CT first, just to make sure that you don't have increased ICP before you start doing anything, right? They don't have like increased risk of herniation or whatever. So I'd certainly go for option B on this one, right? Order an EEG, no, that's for seizures, right? Option A, beta blockers. Beta blockers are not used to manage pseudotumor cerebri. They're not. Pseudotumor cerebri is managed with acetazolamide, which is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. Option D and E, refer for consultation. Well, do you know what's going on yet? No, you don't. figure out what's going on first before you start disturbing our other healthcare professionals. All right. And again, I've just noticed, I'm not saying that this is an absolute rule, but I've noticed in many circumstances, consulting other people is usually an unwise move on the USMLE exams. All right, question 18. A 16-year-old high school student whose prenatal course you have managed gave birth to a 3,256-gram, that's a 7-pound-3-ounce baby, girl, during the night with the assistance of your associate. On morning rounds, you note that the delivery records report that she had mildly elevated blood pressures during labor and sustained an estimated third-stage blood loss of 500 milliliters. Today, blood pressure is 132 over 84, she's afebrile, and deep tendon reflexes are normal. The uterine fundus is firm and at the level of the umbilicus, and her perineum is slightly edematous. Hematocrit is 33%, she is coddling her infant, and normal bonding seems to be occurring. Which of the following is the most important next step in management, right? This is like a benign question. She just happens to be a teenage mom, but everything seems to be going pretty fine for her. So you probably want to pick the most benign answer here. Option A says begin oral ferrous sulfate. Option B says begin oral methyl doper. Option C says institute fundal massage. Option D says other daily seeds baths. Option E says provide education for well-baby care. Personally, I just do option E. It's a benign answer. Seeds baths are for... they're for like hemorrhoids and stuff. I wouldn't do that here. Institute fundal massage. Why are we doing that? This person's uterus is going down in size. The uterus is not going to contract all the way down to the pubic symphysis right after delivery. No, right? It takes a while. So I'm not going to do option C. Option B says begin oral methyl doper. A blood pressure is not that bad. Option A says begin oral ferrous sulfate. A hematocrit is 33%, right? You know, that may just reflect acute blood loss, you know, because she just delivered. Just kind of chill out, right? Her numbers should rejigger and become better over time, right? So I'm gonna go with option E. This person is fine, baby's fine, everyone seems to be doing pretty well. All right, so we're gonna go to question number 19 and 20. It's a kind of a pair. So a 55-year-old man who has a long history of alcohol dependence comes to the office for his yearly follow-up visit. He has consumed 2 pints of vodka daily for many years. That's a lot of vodka. And has a past history of blackout episodes during intoxication. Following a divorce from his second wife, he voluntarily detoxified himself, but this was complicated by rum fits with tactile and visual hallucinations, right? So it kind of seems like he had withdrawal. His medical history includes hypercholesterolemia controlled by diet, BPH, and hypertension, for which he takes an alpha-blocking medication. During the course of the examination, he tells you his twin brother recently died of colon cancer. Oh, that sucks. It is clear from the conversation that he was very close to his brother. Man, that sucks. And he feels that his only support system has left him. You discuss your concerns about his reliance on alcohol as a coping mechanism and ask if he would consider accepting help during this difficult time. He agrees. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step? Option A says, arrange for referral to a substance abuse treatment program while the patient is in the office. Option B, prescribe diazepam. Option C, prescribe disulfiram and discuss with him its use and potential withdrawal symptoms. Option D, refer him to Alcoholics Anonymous. Option E, suggest he attend an outpatient substance abuse treatment program in his area. All right, so let's look at a few things here. Right, this guy has agreed to quit drinking. Okay, so we know that the right answer has to be some answer that helps with quitting the consumption of alcohol, right? So maybe don't pick option B. We use that for like acute alcohol withdrawal. I would not pick option C, especially when there's other answers that could work that are available, right? Disulfiram is rarely ever used. It is used only if you're like extremely motivated, right? So I would not pick that. Answer is generally not first line, generally going to be the wrong answer on exams for alcohol use disorder, right? Option A, arrange for referral to a substance abuse treatment program. Okay, I mean, this person has agreed, so that's good. Option E says, suggest he attend an outpatient substance abuse treatment program in his area. Option D says, refer to Alcoholics Anonymous. Those three answers that I just reeled off are good. But again, this guy seems to have pretty severe alcohol use disorder, right? So since he has pretty severe alcohol use disorder, I probably wouldn't want to do just Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to use something a little more, something a little stronger, right? You know, so I think option A makes sense, right? You're literally arranging treatment while the person is in the office, right? I mean, it's almost like you're catching this guy in a moment of vulnerability, which is good, because it's like, wow, okay, let me quit drinking, right? So you're catching him at a good time, right? Don't wait until it's too late, right? So I think I'm gonna go to option A, because option A is almost like a more urgent answer than option E. Option E is like suggest. How many patients take our suggestions? So I go with option A, right? Arrange for treatment. And the thing is, a kind of an analogous concept they can test on your exams involves heart failure. When a person is admitted to the hospital for a CHF exacerbation, you typically want to ensure that they have, like, literally their follow-up appointments, especially with heart failure clinics, set up before they leave the hospital, right? Because that decreases the risk of them being readmitted to the hospital. All right. Now, question 20, last question for today. Which of the following features in this patient's history is most closely associated with the risk of morbidity or mortality from alcohol withdrawal? Well, the thing is, option A says absence of social support. Option B says blackout episodes during intoxication. Option C says family history of colon cancer. Option D says previous history of withdrawal seizures. Option E says use of alpha blocking medications. Absence of social support, you know, risk from withdrawal. The absence of social support, it just means that he may not be successful with therapy, may not be as successful. Blackout episodes, that deals more with the intoxication than the withdrawal. Family history of colon cancer has no bearing on your withdrawal from alcohol. Option D says previous history of withdrawal seizures. Okay, so he's had this problem before. He has tried to quit on his own. That's actually worrisome. I actually will go with option D here, but we'll talk about that. Option E says use of an alpha blocking medication. No, right? No. That doesn't make any sense, right? That doesn't make any sense. Alpha blockers are not really used for alcohol withdrawal. They don't really have any big role in alcohol. You know, if a person has alcohol use disorder, you can put them on naltrexone or he can proceed, but that's not really what's going on here. So I'm going to go with option D, right? Because the thing is, one thing people don't realize is that when you drink a lot, right, drinking makes you produce a lot of GABA and reduce the amount of glutamate, right? So remember, GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. Glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter, right? So what basically happens? Well, the thing that happens is that because you're making so much GABA, your CNS becomes used to too much GABA. So your GABA receptors start being downregulated. But because you're reducing the production of an excitatory neurotransmitter like glutamate, your CNS is going to make more glutamate receptors. You're going to upregulate glutamate receptor production, right? So that's part of why alcohol withdrawal can cause seizures, because you're upregulating receptors that are excitatory, glutamate receptors, right? Those are NMDA receptors. You know, they are responsive to glutamate. So if you upregulate glutamate receptors and downregulate GABA receptors, right? And again, you're downregulating GABA receptors because there's too much GABA, because alcohol makes you make a ton of GABA. And you're upregulating glutamate receptors because you're making less glutamate and alcohol reduces glutamate production, right? That can lower your seizure threshold and cause you to have seizures, right? And the thing is, alcoholics, one thing that's kind of high to know with them is if they keep trying to quit, but then they start it again, they quit, they restart it again, they quit, they restart it again. This thing about downregulating GABA receptors, upregulating glutamate receptors becomes more and more pronounced. And whenever you have upregulated sensitized receptors, that can put you in a very, very bad place, right? So like, for example, I just like to think of it this way, where if a receptor is like very sensitized, very upregulated, then you can have like very profound effects to exposure to that substance, right? So kind of keep that in mind, right? So those people, because you're upregulating glutamate receptors, you're sensitizing those glutamate receptors, those people, if they withdraw, they can have like more violent withdrawals, right? So I believe that this is known as a kindling effect, right? It's like kindling a fire, right? So it's like, oh, each withdrawal, your next withdrawal is going to be worse than your last withdrawal, right? Because again, of this kindling effect, right? So I'm going to go with option D for this one. So you love the way I teach, you love the way I explain, you love the way I integrate, you love the way I explain pathophase. You'll love my classes. I have classes for step one all the way to step three that begin on Monday next week. If you want specific information on these classes, shoot me an email. I'll give you some more information. I'm the one that teaches all my classes. I don't subcontract it to anybody. I teach all the classes and they're pretty much entirely problem-based, right? I go through concepts. I go through content. I go through pathophase. I go through testing principles, right? And I have a big 50-hour class, step two, step three class in June, 10 days, 50 hours, really, really amazing, really, really comprehensive class. So if you're interested, shoot me an email, you know, for any of these classes. I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and Complex exams and med school exams. I also help with applications, you know, ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements. And then, you know, check out these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify podcasts. And then, you know, I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective I address a life lesson. I have about almost 400 episodes on there. So I will see you, God willing, in episode 641. That's going to be series 3 here. But thank you for joining me today. Have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.